This is a lecture given at St. David's Episcopal Church in Austin, Texas. Visit our website, stdave.org.
All right, folks, I'm going to go ahead and get us started, and maybe some others will join us because I think the 9 o'clock service ran a little long, but I want to honor Reverend Norton's time and give her all that she needs to be able to teach us about womanist biblical interpretation. So this is the last in our series on biblical interpretation. And so we have Reverend Yolanda Norton with us today. And she is a PhD candidate at Vanderbilt Divinity School and a visiting professor at Moravian University, and is the creator and the curator of the Beyoncé Mass. And maybe she'll tell us a little more about that later. And she was a visiting professor at Seminary of the Southwest last year as the Crump Black Scholar in theology. So she has a passion for the Hebrew Bible. So, of course, that's near and dear to my heart. And she also focuses her work on Genesis and the Book of Ruth. And I wrote my dissertation on Ruth. And so I'm excited to hear what she has to say today. So welcome, Reverend Norton, and so come and share your wisdom with us.
Thank you. Do this obligatory motion, get rid of the mask so that people can see. Good morning. Yep, still morning. Good morning, everyone. It's good to be with you. I'm going to dive right in. So when we talk about womanist biblical interpretation, it's really important for me that we do first some historical work, then some ethical work. And this kind of speaks to the frame and method that I use to frame my own conversations about biblical interpretation, specifically womanist biblical interpretation. So I'm going to say something first about feminist. So feminist is theoretical perspective stating that women are uniquely and systemically oppressed, and that challenges idea of gender and sex roles. You have first wave feminism that comes about in the early 20th century, when we're talking about issues of equality through voting and labor issues, and second wave feminism that comes about in the late 60s and 70s that talks about the objectification of women and focuses on issues of reproductive justice. Well, I really want to park on this first wave of feminist and why we're creating this distinction between feminist and womanist. In a moment, I will give you the definition of a womanist, but I want to start with a story from Alice Walker. So Alice Walker, who really kind of brings this term womanist into the public sphere, the author of Pulitzer Prize winning book, The Color Purple. She, up until the late 70s, identifies herself as a feminist, and particularly would say, I'm a Black feminist. And she realizes that the very need to articulate herself as a Black feminist is a function of the fact that the feminist movement has not found healthy or just space to center the issues that are important to non-white women. And so this becomes really important when we talk about issues of equality around voting and labor. Why? First of all, because any kind of historical analysis about the suffrage movement says that you had Black women who were fighting alongside of white women for the right to vote. And it was a conscious decision on the part of the leaders of the suffrage movement to distance themselves from these Black women and decide it wasn't worth losing their vote in order to help ensure that Black women got the right to vote. So the very one of the very core tenets of this movement necessarily isolates Black women, right? So anyone who has heard or read Sojourner Truth's Ain't I a Woman knows that this is actually a response to Black women being ostracized in the suffrage movement. And so she gets up in a convention in Seneca Falls and says, hey, ain't I a woman too? If we're going to talk about women's right to vote, why are we not ensuring that Black women have the right to vote? So this automatically starts to move Black women outside of the feminist movement. The second place that this becomes important is when we talk about labor issues. Why? Because when white women are talking about the desire to go into the workforce, it That whole issue negates the fact that Black women are already in the workforce and primarily in the workforce as domestics in white households. And that when white women go into the workforce, it actually forces increased labor for Black women and pulls them out of their own homes even more. So you have the first wave of the feminist movement really creating additional burden and lessening the rights of Black women, not increasing them. So there's a tension that's created there. Alice Walker starts to pick up on this tension that evolves over the years. And so she suggests there's no hospitable space for me in this movement. And so she publishes an article in Ms. Magazine where she outlines this new articulation of her identity of liberation and roots it in the term womanist. She then republishes that article in a book called In Search of Our Mother's Gardens, which is a book of womanist prose, includes this definition of womanist. So from Walker, we get a four-part definition of the term womanist. And she says from womanish. So while Walker introduced this kind of official term womanist, the term womanish exists in Black vernacular long before Alice Walker. And it really is something that points to the idea that Black girls are often forced ripen, forced to age ahead of their time, and exist in a quandary and a conundrum, because it means that life has necessitated that you have a set of skills that are beyond what society has deemed normal for girls. But even though life has necessitated that reality, we vilify those characteristics when they manifest themselves in the world. So she talks about this full expression of, you acting womanish, like a woman, someone who is courageous, who is willful, who kind of lacks the timidity that people want from a young girl. So, and wanting to know more than what people would say is good for you, for a child. So acting grown up. And so this is the first part of her definition. It's a four-part definition. The second tenet or definition of womanist, she says, is that a womanist is one who loves other women sexually and non-sexually and prefers women's culture, celebrates something about women's emotional flexibility, understands the value of tears, laughter, and a range of emotional expressions, understands that that's really the only way that we come to wholeness is if we can live in anger and joy, laughter and tears, right? And that all of those encompass one's wellness. And someone who is committed to the wholeness of an entire people, male and female. The thing that I really like about this definition that people often miss is that she says that Black women are committed to the wholeness of an entire people, but that the second piece of what she says is that we are universalists, except for when it's not good for our health. And so when it's not good for our physical and emotional health, it becomes important that we separate ourselves from communities and from relationships. And I think that is important because there are all kinds of ways that Black women, you know, there are psychological, sociological studies about Black women's superwoman syndrome and Black women being the idea that people try to impose themselves on the body and the psyche of Black women. So this ability and need to name that while we are committed to the wholeness of an entire people, it is our right and our responsibility to separate ourselves out when things are not healthy or well. So the third part of the definition, Walker says that womanist loves music, loves dance, loves the moon, loves the spirit, loves love, food, roundness, struggle, just loves. And importantly, loves herself regardless. And the regardless is regardless of what people think about her, how people have constructed Black female identity, what people think is right or proper or good. Regardless is crucial to understanding the audacity of womanist identity. And then she says, womanist is to feminist as purple is to lavender. And Stacey Floyd Thomas, who's a womanist theological ethicist, has a book called Deeper Shades of Purple, And so she adds this kind of tagline, woman is to feminist as purple is to lavender. It is a deeper shade of purple, meaning that it deals with issues of intersectionality that the feminist movement has often failed to deal with, right? This is going to become important as we develop a womanist biblical interpretive understanding. So this is our definition of womanism writ large. And I'll say this, I'm going to leave time for questions at the end. But if there are questions, things that are unclear as I'm moving along, please feel free to raise your hand and I'll try to clarify as it comes. So if we take the definition of womanism, I think it then becomes important to frame something about a womanist ethic. Womanist ethics, particularly Stacey Floyd Thomas in her book, Mining the Motherlode, decides that it's time that we really frame a methodology for womanist ethics. And so she says there are four tenets that are wrapped up that kind of sit within these four definitions of womanism. And the four tenets are radical subjectivity, traditional communalism, redemptive self-love, and critical engagement. What is radical subjectivity? Radical subjectivity is an understanding that while we exist in categories and we have everything is relative to something else, that there's something about Black women that we decide that the categories will not dictate where we situate ourselves, but we will use those categories as something that upends people's expectations and the structures that have been created around society. So in other words, whatever you've decided that I am because I'm a Black woman, I'm going to use your expectations of who I am to create a liberative space. And I find this kind of parallel to this biblical notion of the trickster, right? So the trope of the trickster in the Hebrew Bible is such that in times of chaos, all kinds of societal norms are upended, and people who are disenfranchised find ways to use that to create liberative space that wasn't otherwise there. So this is kind of understanding of womanist radical subjectivity. Traditional communalism. We offer traditional communalism as a counterbalance, a response to the idea of rugged individualism, right? So we exist in a society that talks all the time about the idea that one would pull themselves up by their own bootstraps, which is actually physically impossible, right? Like if you're standing on it, you're not pulling yourself up. And so the idea that we live in this false meritocracy, right? Womanism calls that out and says, actually, what we should stop valuing is this idea that some people are superior to others. Some people have certain kind of skills that are better, more valuable, more profitable than others, and instead start to value people who invest in the whole of community and understand that whatever skills that you have as an individual, when you bring them into collective space, then we create a more just and equitable society. So traditional communalism, redemptive self-love. We live in a world that has decided that there are only certain personality types, certain body types, certain skin colors, certain phenotypes that we will value and love. If you turn on the TV, there are norms about what one should look like, one should act like. And the idea, going back to Alice Walker's definition, that Black women would love herself regardless. It is an understanding that the decision to love yourself despite what society has tried to put upon you is redemptive. It is a part of God's salvific work in the world. And then critical engagement, which suggests that all the first three tenets are useless if we don't figure out a way to put them in the world in ways that call for justice. This has become incredibly important for me in my own research. It's to suggest that I can do all of the research that I want to do. I can stand in spaces and places that my ancestors couldn't stand in. I can write books and articles that other people weren't given the opportunity to write. But if none of those things have space in church and society in ways that fight for the liberation of of other people, then why do the research? Why do the work? Why teach the classes if there's not something that is critically engaging and paradigm shifting? So these are the kind of tenets of a methodology of womanism. And so all of those things inform, in my mind, where we arrive at womanist biblical interpretation. And I want to say something about the history of womanist biblical interpretation so you understand how new this field is. It is in 1981 that Clarice Martin gets a PhD in New Testament from Duke University. It's not until 1986 that Renita Weems becomes the first Black woman to get a PhD in Hebrew Bible from Princeton Theological Seminary. There will be people who would tell you, if you had invited some other womanist biblical scholar, they might tell you that we're in the fourth or the fifth generation of womanist scholars. My math, my sense of sociology, my sense of biblical generations won't allow me to put us in a fourth or fifth generation when we're talking about a field that is so new, a field that has been birthed really in biblical interpretation in my lifetime. So what we have is these two Black women who shift the paradigm of biblical interpretation. And, you know, Renita Weems, if we talk about her in particular, she gets her PhD from Princeton in 1986. It's 2 years before she finishes her PhD at Princeton that she starts teaching at Vanderbilt University. She publishes her first book that is separate from her dissertation while she's dissertating and teaching at Vanderbilt. She does all of this, and it is still the case that when she goes up for tenure at Vanderbilt, they deny her. And they decide that she doesn't have the scholarly rigor to have tenure. She petitions, she gets tenure, and she leaves Vanderbilt, and she says, I'll never work at a modern plantation again. And so she has stepped outside of theological education proper because she doesn't want to be involved in these systems that really have not found space for Black women in particular. So we have that first generation, and these are not all of the scholars, but this is just a smattering of who we have. Clarice Martin finishes at Duke, goes to teach at Princeton, has similar kind of tensions at Princeton, leaves Princeton and goes to Colgate Rochester, where she currently teaches now. Second generation of scholars, we have fabulous people like Mitzi Smith, who has written books on African-American biblical interpretation. She has a wonderful book on womanist sass. She's that deals with the New Testament and ideas of willfulness in the New Testament. Will Gaffney, who has written on the prophets and women, who has a new womanist lectionary that's just come out, Episcopal clergy. Valerie Bridgman, who is the dean at Methodist Theological Seminary of Ohio, who's done some great work on the Psalter. I would put those people in a second generation, and I would maybe say we're just now starting to inch into a third generation, people like Chanel Smith, who's written in the New Testament on womanist thought and apocalypticism, Kim Russell, who's written on daughters, Shively Smith, who writes on the Johannine letters and empire. This is my generation of womanist scholars. Part of the reason these generations even feel thin to me is that the latest study suggests that there are about 30 Black women in the world with PhDs in Hebrew Bible. There are 9 of us teaching in institutions of higher education in Hebrew Bible. And then in New Testament, that number goes to about 60 who have PhDs in New Testament and about 21 who are teaching. So we really are talking about something that we haven't found space for. One of the tensions when we talk about any kind of post-colonial reading of the text is this question that in my mind reinforces the white supremacy and elitism of biblical interpretation of whether or not we can even name womanist biblical hermeneutics as a method. Is it a method or is it just a reading? And this is one of the critiques that has come out of the discipline as of late, which just says there's nothing central about how we do womanist biblical interpretation. It's just an interaction about Black women's identity and the Bible. And I would argue back that if we start to break that issue down, we could deconstruct most things that we would call methods of interpretation. And I would say that what we do when we do womanist biblical interpretation is ask questions about the intersection of gender, race, and class as we read a particular text. And this is the place where one of my students would normally raise their hand and say, well, what do we do with this issue of race? I say, that's a great question, because race in and of itself is a 19th century construct, and we are talking about ancient texts, that there was not this kind of phenotypical distinction that we live with now that informs what's happening in the biblical world. And so for that reason, when we do womanist biblical interpretation, from my kind of methodological standpoint, we talk about race as parallel to othering. So, you know, there are those scholars who have said in the kind of mid 20th century that, oh, we should talk about race as compared to ethnicity in the Hebrew Bible. But I would say that even ethnicity is something that is newer than the world of like the Hebrew Bible. And so it's really a question of how are people deciding within a community who belongs and who doesn't? And that those conversations about how structures are created for who belongs and who doesn't informs a race conversation that we would have in the Hebrew Bible. Pause there. Questions?
The wars in the Old Testament and the tension between different groups, as well, that is a narrative. Can you say a little bit about that? Warring ties.
So I'm going to do an exercise where we're going to walk through a specific text, and I'm going to try to make sense of that. And so I think that will get at, yeah, that piece. But I want to make sure before we get in, there aren't any questions about the history, the ethics, the methodology. Okay. So we're going to go into the Book of Ruth. And so what I would say off the bat and trying to provide some framework for the Book of Ruth is we have a text that, and when we approach a text, for me, I start with questions of history and literature and then deal with the kind of social and political issues that are raised in the text. So we talk about the Book of Ruth. Scholars across time have basically decided that there are three arguments about when we might date this text. There's a, maybe we date this text to the time when judges judge because of the first verse of the Book of Ruth. Ruth 1:1 says in the days when judges judged, right? So, that's a possibility. The problem with that argument is that it's kind of circular because we actually don't know the days that judges judge. So if you're going to argue about when Judges is written, then how is that going to help you understand something about when Ruth was written? So then we start to get to this idea that the Book of Ruth was written in the time of the monarchy, and that it is an apologetic for David, right? So this idea, how can David be king of Israel if David doesn't have pure Israelite ancestry, right? Because we know that he has some Moabite ancestry, and so how is he going to be king? And so this text is put forward as potentially a mechanism of making sense of how he could still be king. And they really draw from the end of Ruth 4, where it gives this lineage about David. And so maybe this is why, how we date this text is to the period of the monarchy. And so we've started to get more conversation in the past kind of 30-ish years about the text being a function of the exilic period. Some would say Persian, myself included. Some would say later. I'll get back to this argument about the Persian exilic period. But it's also that we deal with the literature of it, that this is a novella. It's a short, episodic, historical fiction, more fiction than history, right? In that it is a fictive narrative that is supposed to indicate for a reader something about the customs and the ethics of a people, rather than document some facts, some data about what's happening in the life of ancient Israel. It's akin to saying, I'm gonna read a Jane Austen novel and understand that all these characters didn't exist, but it tells us something about the cultures and the behaviors of the people who were living in that particular era. So we have this novella. Part of the reason why some of us would attach the Book of Ruth to the exilic period, to the Persian period, is that there's this conversation that's happening in Ezra and Nehemiah that pops up across ancient Israel, which is one, in the exilic period, right? They have been exiled. And there's a question of who can the men marry? So this concept of exogamy. And we see most pointedly in Ezra and Nehemiah, this conversation about a prohibition of intermarriage, that we don't want the men to marry foreign women, because one of the things that's within the domain of the wife is the household. The thing that's in the domain of that wife is the household, which means that she's responsible for the education, including the religious education of the children. If you marry someone who's not a part of the Yahwistic cult, then how are they going to raise the children in this kind of religious foundation? And so Nehemiah 13, verses 23 to 31, and Ezra 9 and 10 really spend a good amount of time talking about a prohibition of marrying foreign women and the consequences of violating that. And part of what I would argue is that if you look at Ruth 1, verses 16 and 17, what you see is this vow that Ruth takes. Your people will be my people. Your God will be my God, right? That this vow is one of assimilation. It's one that requires that she shed the identity of her people for the sake of Judah. And therefore, part of the argument is that it offers an explanation of when an Israelite man can marry a foreign woman. And the when is when that woman will shed something about her own identity for the sake of promoting Israel as this holy, divine, extraordinary people. And so for my purposes, again, we're talking about othering. If you look at the first chapter of the Book of Ruth, one of the things that we know about literature is that repetition matters. The more that the author says something, it's not an accident. It really, they're trying to emphasize something. And you begin the Book of Ruth with all of these references to Moab and Moabite. And our good biblical scholars will tell you, and so this is part of this kind of interplay between Ruth and Genesis, the biblical scholars will tell you that, like, at least for a Bible reader or an understander of the like ecologies and literature of ancient Israel, reference to Moab points you back to an etiology that pops up in Genesis that tells you that, like, these are the descendants of Lot. These are the incestuous people. These are also people who at various points in the Hebrew Bible have been listed as one of the biggest enemies of Israel. So there's something established about Ruth that automatically puts her in a kind of counter distinction with the people of Israel and of Bethlehem. And so there are those who have said that if you read kind of the Talmud and some other kind of rabbinic responses to the Book of Ruth, they will suggest to you two things about Elimelech and his family. They'll first suggest to you that if you were to look at this family, the very idea that they could leave in a famine might suggest that they have resources that other people don't. If the idea was to leave because there are no resources, why wasn't there a mass exodus? Why was there only one family? And so part of that conversation is rooted in this understanding that as a historical fictive piece of literature, this family would have been representative of the people who were exiled. And what do we know about the people who were exiled? They mostly just exiled the elite class. And so that mirrors something about the movement pattern. But folks die, right? Elimelech dies, the sons die. And there's this conversation that this may have been punitive for not only them leaving their people in times of distress, but also them mixing in with these horrible Moabites. And so the idea that Ruth's vow of assimilation is something that cleanses her and cleanses the sins of this interaction is really pivotal to how the rest of the text unfolds. And so this is what I mean when I say, and you know, if we had more time, we could go through this kind of ad nauseum and in detail. But this is what I mean when I say there's something about this foreign identity, this idea of some people belong and some people don't belong, that speaks to the issues that inform Black women's identity. Now, again, we could go through the whole of Ruth if I had 14 hours and not one. But what I'll jump ahead and say is that Ruth makes this vow. The text says Naomi stopped speaking to her. The church in particular has read that interaction as a kind of quiet resign. I would read that interaction as a kind of hostility, particularly paired with the idea that when Naomi gets back to Bethlehem and the women of Bethlehem say, blessed be Naomi, you know, and she says, don't call me Naomi, call me Mara, which, right, the Hebrew will tell us Naomi means sweet, Mara means bitter. And she says, because I went away full, but the Lord has returned me empty. And, you know, kind of tongue-in-cheek way, I say to my students, if I'm Ruth, I'm big mad right now. Because I've just made a vow of my entire life to you, and your response is silence and then erasure. And then the next moment is that Ruth, when we get to Ruth chapter 2, is Ruth making an imperative, let me go glean in the fields. So in popular translations and readings of the text in ecclesial spaces and otherwise, we always talk about Naomi being the sage, this wisdom, the older person who protects and guides. But it's Ruth who's like, wait, we've got to eat. And she says, go in the field. Now, all Naomi says is go. What the narrator and Boaz gives us a clue to later is that if Ruth had gone into the wrong field, there could have been violence and consequence to that action. Because what does Boaz say? Stay in this field, right? And so it tells us with a hermeneutic of suspicion, it tells us that there is information that Ruth or that Naomi should have known, could have articulated, but does not, possibly because of her own grief, possibly because of her apathy, but all of these things put Ruth in a potential line of danger. And then when Ruth comes back and says, here's some food, Naomi's response is essentially, oh, great, I can ensure some security for us. So she sends Ruth into the threshing floor. And we know a couple of things about threshing floors. We know that literarily when we see a threshing floor in the Bible, it marks a space of transition, right? It's an agricultural space. Threshing floor is where you beat the grain. And so you separate the usable edible material from the waste. And usually when you see that happening agriculturally in the text, it means that the usable material is about to be separated from the non-usable material in the instance of the primary characters of the text. What I would argue is that Ruth is not the primary characters of the text, but what's about to happen is that Boaz and Naomi are about to experience transition because of this interaction at the threshing floor. The other thing we know about the threshing floor, the text tells us very clearly, is that the place that the men go to separate things out and that they eat after they're done with their day's work, they eat and they get drunk. The text tells us they are eating and they are drinking. And so there's some idea that we gloss over that they're, Ruth is exposed to a potential sexual and physical violence, right? Go, Naomi, go sneak in this way. But if she had gotten caught, what's the liability for her? So all of these things happen. Ruth ends up in these potentially dangerous situations. And at the end of the day, so maybe it works out for her. She marries Boaz. But if the women of Bethlehem mark bookends for this text, at the end of the narrative, the women say, "Blessed be Naomi, for the Lord has given her a child." So what does it mean that Ruth puts herself, makes this vow of assimilation, puts herself in potentially dangerous situations, and then at the end of the text, she's still not central to what's happened, this child that has been born. As per the legal and cultural guidelines of Israel, it's not her child. It's Naomi's child. It's about ensuring Naomi's future. And so as a woman, a scholar, right, we go back to that very place that we started in this historical conversation about the voting rights and labor rights. What are the ways that Black women have been asked to make vows of allegiance, vows of assimilation, and they're constantly put in places of danger and overexertion, and then erased from the narrative or made peripheral, right? So there, in readings of this text, we talk about literature, we talk about linguistic translation, we talk about how cultural norms are evaluated in the text, and we name the parallels between those structures and the structures that exist and the realities that exist for Black women. That for me marks an evaluation of how we do womanist biblical interpretation and how we use that to have generative conversations in public spaces about the problems of racism, sexism, xenophobia, classism, and its impact on a society. And I'll pause again for questions. Yeah, so my first career was as a lobbyist for children's issues. My second career was in human resources, but only because I decided to go into ministry, and that let me pay the bills while I was in seminary. And so the idea of being involved in justice movements from the beginning really informs my biblical hermeneutic, right? So the idea that I thought when I was a teenager and worked until my young adulthood to be a lobbyist for children's issues meant that there's always been an impulse in me about how do we fix systemic inequality and talk about those issues. So when I went to seminary, the first book that I was assigned in Intro to Hebrew Bible was two chapters from Renina Weems' Just a Sister Away. And I read this book and I heard this term womanist biblical interpretation, and it was transformative to me because it was the first time that someone was saying to me that the way that I read the text and the issues that are important to me and how I read the text are not peripheral, but central to how we understand the evolution of scripture. And so, you know, at the time I was also working in a church. And so everywhere I went, I was like, we got to read this book and we've got to do this. And it was actually the only thing I enjoyed about that Intro to Hebrew Bible class. And I thought, horrible. And I thought when I got out of that class, I thought, I'll never take another Hebrew Bible class another day in my life. Joke's on me. And so it wasn't, but I did wait until my last semester of seminary to take another class, the elective that I needed to take in Hebrew Bible. And I fell in love with that class. And I thought, well, dang it. I don't know what I'm going to do now. And then talking with a group of my professors asked me to sit down and they said, we really think you should explore getting a PhD The professors in the room, one was a church historian, one was a Hebrew Bible professor, and one was in Christian education. And so they were there because they were committed to the idea of me getting a PhD, and they were also there to duke it out to see which area I would go into. Because I was a lobbyist, because I'm always been a little bit spicy and feisty and like to fight a fight, the idea was compelling to me that there was a severe underrepresentation of Black women in the field of biblical studies, and that there's some pretty concentrated work to keep Black women out of the field, right? And so I thought, well, that feels like a fight I really want to fight. And it is the case that there's no more visceral response that people have than to see a Black woman stand in front of them and talk about sacred text and to be the authority on sacred text. So when I walk into my intro to Hebrew Bible class, particularly when I switch institutions, it's my favorite day, that first day, because if I'm sitting or I'm on a Zoom screen, no one assumes that I could possibly be the professor. So I hear all the things like, have you heard who this Professor Norton is? What's she like? I hear she's real hard. I'm like, yeah, I hear she's a pain. But the shock and awe when I'm the one who stands up, right? That embodiment issue that people run into when they're like, oh, that's a Black woman who's supposed to teach me about my sacred scripture. I really like making people uncomfortable that way. And so that's a part of my work and my journey, is to stand in the space that Black women don't stand in and disrupt people's notion of what we call sacred.
Would you talk a little more about the idea there's no such thing as race, yet the whole womanist movement is situated in race?
Oh, not that there's no such thing as race.
It's not true.
Right. Oh, you mean this broader concept that race is a social construct and not a reality? Yeah, so here's the thing. There are plenty of things that are social constructs that are real. Yes, it is in fact the case that someone decided that we were going to, in the 19th century, that we were going to create classifications based on phenotype, the amount of melanin, the size of one's nose and structure, like all of those things they use to create a system of classification. But we can talk all day long about the ways that people have developed classifications and we live in those classifications as reality. It's only when people have started to say, well, if we're going to talk about race, we need to talk about the justice issues of race, that people have decided, well, now we can have a conversation about race being subjective and imaginary. It's not imaginary. It's something that exists in our society and has real implications on how people live, and maybe just as importantly, how and why people are dying. And so as long as that's a reality that we have to face in this world, and it is, then the work of womanism is to do the work of unpacking and repackaging these conversations about race and power and disrupting people's sense of normativity, right? So when we talk about normative ethics, we're talking about an ethic that decides this is what should be, rather than descriptive ethics, which suggests this is what is, right? And so part of what happens in a womanist biblical interpretation, part of what happens in womanist ethics is a saying, you have to stop taking your norms and pushing them on me as an ethic, right? And you have to name that these are just what things are. And so, for example, when I read the Book of Ruth, it's not about just reading the Book of Ruth and making these observations and claims about what's happening in the text. It's about saying, yes, we should celebrate something about Ruth, because she perseveres in a really crappy situation. She perseveres when people don't have her best interest at heart. But we should also critique Naomi and Boaz and all the other people who do things that are out of their own self-interest that put Ruth at risk. And we should stop calling on Black women to be Ruths and to look for Boazes and to appreciate their Naomis. And so that's the reality of a womanist hermeneutic is to say, to reinforce what Brueggemann says, which is that the text is not universally prescriptive, that more often than not, it's a reflection of who we are and not an idea of who we should be. Mm-hmm. We'll look at the Zoom screen. Sure.
Did you find that what you've seen evolve in your lifetime in regard to this movement? Do you think progress, or how do you feel about the direction it's going?
So I think for me, what has been disheartening, number one is, when I narrate my own experience with womanism, it was so liberative for me. But there are so few people who know this term, who've been exposed to this work. So in terms of the specifics of the evolution of the scholarship, my imperative to my colleagues in this moment is, we've got to get out of this box. Whatever box we've been put in, we have to get out of this box, because it's rare that you find someone who doesn't know what a feminist is. But it's rare that you find someone who knows what a womanist is. And I think that, and maybe more important than people knowing the term, is that people need to know the structures of how the work disrupts normativity. And so that's what concerns me, is that we haven't made that move. And I don't think that that's accidental. Again, right? I think the underrepresentation of Black women in the academy, and the ways that that unfolds, makes it very difficult. And the burden that is put on Black women who are in the academy, when we get there, and the ways that that often compromises our ability to get tenure and to stay, be sustainable in these institutions, makes it very difficult for us to do that kind of, and I hate to use the word, but evangelical work of spreading the good news about how womanism can disrupt readings of the text and systems of oppression.
Well, maybe, can you comment on the reaction or response of Jewish scholars to womanism? Do they even pay attention to it at all? Do they engage with it?
Yeah, I mean, I think, I don't know that there is a lot of interaction, but there's definitely, I come here from the Society of Biblical Literature. So when I'm done, I drive back to San Antonio, and I will sit in spaces with my colleagues in biblical studies. So I would say that there are times when there is a tension, right? But I think that there's also some good congruence, because it's not necessarily, there's no vilification of Judaism, right? It's a commentary on how systems of oppression are built. And so where there is congruence is this understanding of, like, oh, we can have similar conversations about exile and the impact of exile. We can have similar conversations about the imprint of imperialism on the development of community. So I think there is not as much robust interaction, but I do think that where there is interaction, we found real places of synergy.
I missed the introduction of what the definition of the womanism is, but is it, and excuse me if this question is tiny or oversimplified, but is a woman a scholar, a professor, should it be exclusively Black women?
Yes. Yeah. So there are two tensions you have to sit in. A womanist is a Black woman. Now, well, three tensions. You have to be a Black woman to be a womanist. Black women don't have to be womanists. So the whole point of agency and autonomy is that you can choose the label that you put on yourself. So, I often get people who will be like, oh, there's a womanist and there's a woman. It's like, no, that's a Black woman. That's a Black woman, right? But, right, so this is a category of choice. Now, that being said, there's a difference. And this is what I teach my students. There is a difference between being a womanist and doing womanist biblical interpretation. And so part of understanding that a womanist biblical interpretation is the critical evaluation of race, class, gender, othering, class, gender, is that anybody has the ability to pick up the text and do that kind of socio-political analysis of the text, even if you're not a woman. So you can still use the methods and the theories, employ them for the sake of justice, even if you cannot own the moniker.
My question, just very quickly, it's a follow-up on that, in that if we, as a group of clearly very white people, right, wanted to engage as a group in womanist interpretation, that would not be inappropriate.
No.
So I am not saying I am a womanist, yeah, and I am going to lead this conversation, but I would say we white people want to learn more about this and practice it because we feel that it's an important part of our trying desperately to become an anti-racist conversation.
Mm-hmm.
Then that would be, I'm speaking, y'all are sitting here, I was going to do that sometime in the summer and then my life happened and I put in.
Right.
But I have Bill Gaffney's, book
right
on my desk as right a reminder that this is something that I think would be helpful.
Exactly.
And so, but I don't want to miss that. Right?
Yeah. Again, there's a difference between trying to own and appropriate an identity and trying to employ tools for the sake of justice. And that is the nuance and the difference that I articulate is that, like, right, to be a womanist is to be a Black woman. To do womanist work is the possibilities are there. And those possibilities do require and necessitate that you listen to Black women.
Yes.
Yeah.
Great.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Yep. So here. Yes.
I'm curious about women's perspective on gender and how we break down that particular category of feminism. We've got a couple of different ways in terms of thinking about the essentialism biologically of gender, how people own their gender. And this question is coming from a place. Yesterday was the Transgender Day of Remembrance, where we marked the deaths of many Black and Brown trans women.
Mm-hmm.
And so I'm just curious about that.
I would say very simply that the answers to that question in womanism would be as varied, if not more varied, than they are in feminism. If you're asking me, I was just on a panel with a group of other womanist scholars and the guy who was moderating the womanist panel said he thought he had dropped the gauntlet because he said something about trans women and what was the womanist community gonna do about trans women. And I he looked at my face and he said, "Oh, did I stump you, scholar?" I said, "No, you didn't stump me. I'm confused. You asked about trans women are women. I'm done," right? So from my perspective, yes, there are multiple means of categorization. Part of womanism is understanding the importance of one's agency to identify themselves and attach label to themselves. And so I want to honor that in trans women, but my fight for Black women includes a fight for Black trans women. Yeah.
Mine was more of a slight extension of what was being said a little bit earlier. I want the opportunity to correct me if I hear it wrong.
Okay.
What I'm hearing is it's perfectly possible for me as a white woman to be a womanist ally. And is that more or less similar to it being possible to be a great ally in the gay community?
Yes, but so I have to, and this is my own personal bias. There's something about me that cringes when people use the word ally. And this is my own personal way of teaching critical race theory, is that owning ally is not something that an ally gets to do.
Okay.
Exactly.
Thank you.
Yeah. Yeah, right. So it always feels intrusive to me when someone comes up to me and says, "I'm your ally." I'm like, exactly. And that's the beauty of nuance, right? That's my right to determine. And you, I might say, "This is my ally," And another Black person might walk up and be like, but not mine. And that's my right. Yeah. Yeah.
One thing I think it seems really important to have that very specific subject condition to speak from as a womanist. In my experience, when I, you know, in the 70s and 80s, I read a lot of writing by women of color, and then I got to the academy and started studying like French theory, and all these men talking about power, knowledge, characters, and it's like they're sort of doing the same thing, but from this like totally abstract humanist standpoint, you know, and I think it's really important for Black women and women of color to claim that voice, because it came from.
Right. And, you know, there's some, you know, I have a very tenuous relationship with the likes of Foucault and these conversations about categories. And in part because categories were fine until you start getting called out for your category, right, of power. And then it was like, oh, let's make these categories more malleable and this is all subjective and right. And so this conversation about categories in the academy really has been a way for people to be able to absolve themselves of responsibility and issues of white supremacy and patriarchy. And so absolutely all of these kind of concepts of knowing and category have come out of these like kind of Black female spaces. And I want to, what I like about womanism is the saying, we're articulating some clear categories for the sake of our own survival. And you don't get to muddy those things, right? For the sake of kind of disorienting my claiming my epistemologies. Yeah. Other questions? Thank you.
You can find more lectures and sermons on iTunes by searching for St. David's Episcopal Church in Austin, Texas, or visit our website at saintdave.org and click on the podcast button.